right.
Good morning. How were your travels?
Wonderful. I saw a World Heritage site that is just out of this world, in outside of Brisbane on the Great Barrier Reef, a sand isle with original virgin forest and trees 100 meters high, straight as arrows, lakes that are the purest I've ever seen. Just
wow.
Just
wow.
Awesome in the best sense of that word.
Wow. That's beautiful.
Yes,
that's
it
beautiful.
Was.
Wow, I feel like we should get off the phone and just go there right now.
We can in mind.
Absolutely. That's beautiful. What a beautiful setting for our dialogue. That is completely, completely delightful report. And we are welcome to everyone else in the dialogue. We are live with a report of God's nature from Suzanne Cook Reuter. And this is Mark Gosney. And we're together again for our second dialogue, what we might call Kelly and Diane called yesterday, Unique Self and Levels of Consciousness Reloaded. So take two, part two. So we, Suzanne and I spoke, must have been about 4 months ago before Integral Spiritual Experience 1. And we had an initial, you know, searching conversation just to kind of, you know, wet our feet, as it will, and let Unique Self visit and, you know, touch base and, you know, begin to interact with levels of consciousness in general, and particularly with some elements of Suzanne's particular model of ego development. And what's happened in the interim is that Suzanne and I were both delighted to be together with many other fantastic people at Integral Spiritual Experience, you know, take one, you know, year one. And so we have a deeper sense now of Unique Self in action, you know, after the conference. And now we're really coming together for, you know, who knows what will happen in it. But what we think is an important dialogue, and quite a few people have kind of tracked the conversations before the dialogue, Ken, Suzanne, myself, Zach Stein, I think a couple other people weighed in, you know, Diane, you know, kind of chatted a little bit on email, you know, for, you know, a round of email exchanges a few weeks back preparing for this dialogue. And so now we're really ready to just have a conversation about how this construct, you know, this construct in the first, second, and third person, you know, called Unique Self, this level of consciousness, which is really what Unique Self is, this particular expression of consciousness, right, interfaces with levels of consciousness in general, and particularly, you know, it would be delightful to talk about how it interfaces with levels of consciousness, particularly, Suzanne, in your model. And so just to give us a framework and then to turn over to Suzanne, right, and for anyone who wants to track this in their own research, right, the particular article I chose of Suzanne's, you know, to look at, you know, for this particular dialogue is an article that was published, I think, in 2005. But it's adapted and expanded, Suzanne, from something that you wrote in 1985, and it's called Ego Development, 9 Levels of Increasing Embrace. So I reread that article last night. Mariana, my partner, wasn't that happy about that because she wanted to watch a movie with me instead. But I said, no, I've got to reread Suzanne's article, right, because last time I made a slight mistake in one of the levels of consciousness, and I'd hate to do that again. So, right. So I reread the article last night, and so let's begin. Does that sound like a good framework?
Yes, and even after ISE, I'm still puzzled with the construct, which doesn't mean it's not absolutely worthwhile grappling with it.
No, well, wait. You know, being puzzled is excellent. You know, the beginning of great inquiry. So why don't I then begin? And I thought about it last night. Why don't I begin with a very, very short, you know, kind of statement on Unique Self, and then actually, you know, begin to look at different levels, you know, particularly in your model, and let's just then see and begin to see, you know, how they might play together. You know, what's interesting is that when I looked a little bit at your writing yesterday evening, right, it's interesting to see how uniqueness comes up, right, and where uniqueness comes up in the levels of consciousness. And of course, you could actually look through your article, Suzanne, and begin to see where you use the word unique. Right? You actually even use the word unique self in one place in the article, particularly unique selves. And you know how unique this actually begins to appear, right, at different levels of consciousness, right, in actually your writing. So I thought that was actually completely fascinating. But let's keep that for a little bit later in our dialogue. So let me just be very, very brief. And I want this to work not just for Suzanne and I, but for anyone listening to the dialogue. So I'm going to ask myself and Suzanne that as we talk about things, not to talk in only shorthand, but to talk in a way that someone who hasn't been in the conversation can really track us. So here's the first opening foray of two, three minutes, and then, you know, to Suzanne, and we'll begin our gentle unfolding and gentle probing. So when we talk about unique self, you know, what do we mean? So said very, very simply, right, there's what I've begun to call not the doctrine, because doctrine sounds like a church word, but I call the Dharma of the Four Selves that I've been developing for a number of years and that we used as a model in ISE. And I use it in my upcoming book on unique self that our good colleague Ken Wilber wrote a wonderful introduction to. And the doctrine of four selves is very simple. Separate self, false self, true self, and unique self. And the way I'm using those words is separate self being your very simple, you know, kind of skin encapsulated ego, right? In Bateson's phrase, your experience of yourself as a separate self, pure and simple, right? That's the first stage. And that stage actually comes after, truth be told, an earlier stage, which I'm not even going to address here, which is, you know, the pre-personal stage. And it's before you emerge, in some sense, as a separate self. So it actually more formally would be a pre-personal stage, a pre-personal self. Then there's an emergence of a separate self. Then, right, the next level, right, level three, if you want to be accurate, pre-personal self, separate self, at level three, you have, right, an observing ego, to borrow Freud's wonderful term, comes online, and you begin to see that there's actually different versions of your separate self, what we like to call a healthy separate self and a not healthy separate self, or, and this is what we emailed a lot about, you know, Suzanne, and you questioned the term separate self, and Ken and I defended it, you know, but however we tell the story, you know, the false self is a distorted version of your separate self experience. However it's distorted, however we tell that story. You know, the false self is a term that Winnicott liked a lot. So your false self is an unhealthy version or a distorted version, right, of your separate self that needs clarification in some form. Then, right, and again, I'm not describing a linear process per se, although it often does emerge in this order, but what we called at ISC, not stages, but stations, right, to distinguish from a linear precise unfolding. Then the next level, level four, would be the emergence of true self, which is what's kind of classically termed enlightenment. True self is a classical enlightenment stage where you've moved beyond, let me be really precise here, you've moved beyond the exclusive identification with your separate self. You're no longer exclusively identified with your separate self. Your separate self is still present, right? It's still real. You're not psychotic. You haven't lost your connection to your separate self, but you've expanded your identity. You've stepped into your wholeness as part of this larger unitive scheme. And I'm using unitive in a general sense here, not in a precise sense as in your stages. Right? So that's your true self. And then, right, what begins to emerge most clearly, it's not that it doesn't exist before, but what begins to emerge in its most clear and delineated sense out of your true self is what we've called, you know, your unique self, and your unique self, right, is, if you will, right, the precise configuration of your true self. And the way we like to say it is that because every true self lives in form, if you would say it from a Buddhist, right, framework, or from a Judeo-Christian framework, right, every spirit lives, right, in some incarnation. Right, so whether you call it Nagarjuna's emptiness and form is emptiness, or you have more of a Christian Judaic sense, right, of spirit becomes flesh, spirit incarnates, right, because of that intrinsic reality of the universe, so there's always a precise configuration, a precise perspective, right, to every true self. Every true self has its own unique perspective, right? And true self plus perspective, right, in our formulation, right, equals unique self. True self plus perspective equals unique self, the formulation that Ken likes to give to this particular conversation. And what's really emerged over the last, five, six, 7 years of Ken and I talking about this is this sense that we're very, very strong about, that actually your true self, you know, has unique configuration. It's a particularized expression of all that is. Right? If we would talk in divine terms or in God terms, and again, when I say God, I don't mean the mythic God, but, you know, the God you don't believe in doesn't exist, right? God particularizes his or her essence in you, as you, and through you. Or there's a unique expression of your Buddha nature. Your bodhicitta has a unique configuration, and that in its highest expression is your unique self, which is a clarified expression of that which emerges earlier, right? You know, at earlier stages, you know, glimmerings that emerge, you know, at the egoic stage, etc. So that's just a broad, you know, overall kind of sense, vision, right, of unique self. And now perhaps just maybe start with initial reactions or thoughts from you, Suzanne. And then what I thought we might do, if you feel, you know, it might be productive, is we can actually, you know, trace where the term uniqueness begins to appear in your writing, right, and where it comes online, which I think are the beginnings of the glimmerings of unique self, and your references to uniqueness, which I marked in my, and I'll be glad to read back to you as we go along, actually get clearer and clearer as you go up levels of consciousness, right, in your writing. So that's at least an opening and a beginning. So passing it over to you, Suzanne Cook-Greuter.
Okay, I like the idea that you actually cite, since I haven't recently gone back there and looked at where I used the unique self. It's obviously I used it not in the deeply informed way that we're using it now. I used it more in the conventional way. We used the word unique.
That's right.
So having said that, my biggest beef earlier was with the term false, and I mean, everywhere I go, I think about what else could one say that doesn't rub me the wrong way as well as saying, so why am I so hooked in some ways talking with the thing of fixation and attention? What does that say about me? It's also a question that, of course, comes up. Nonetheless, I do still look for a term. The separate self makes complete sense to me. It's the false self, which kind of seems to me is, as long as we are not enlightened, there is always an element of falseness, of attention that's placed in places where it shouldn't be, ideally. It's just part of being a human being that there are delusions and things we don't see. And to call that false just still rankles me in some ways, because perhaps one of the things I'm hoping to do in writing a book is actually the rehabilitation of ego.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel it gets so much abuse, and people talk about killing it, and again saying it's false. Of course you can do that, but it seems to me that comes from a conventional correct false kind of perspective, and I just wish that when we are integral that we have a later kind of perspective and a more careful wording of things than this dichotomous, you know, false, right, or I don't know what the opposite would be. Authentic is another one. To me, every self is authentic in the sense that it is what it is. Deluded or not, it's still what probably the best that person can at that moment be. And so, or it's authentic just as a worm or a snake or whatever is authentic in the way they are. And
well, let, mm, Let's begin with that conversation, because that's a great conversation, and I actually got a clearer sense today than in our email exchange with Ken, right, about what your objection is. I just got a better sense of what your objection is. So let me try and reflect it back to you and then respond to it, but first let's make sure that I've understood the objection properly. So what you're saying, Suzanne, is that from a non-dual perspective, everything emerges as it emerges, you know, in the way that it emerges, and everything simply is. And since, you know, since there's an enormous amount of literature, and I, by the way, agree with your critique of that literature, right, which is about kind of killing the ego, ego death, evolution beyond the ego, you know, and I'm aware that your research, and I spoke briefly to Terry O'Fallon, and I know that she's emerged from some of your work, right, you've kind of pointed out that the notion of ego death is actually inaccurate simply from an empirical research perspective, and that ego actually exists, as it were, up and down levels of consciousness, and what shifts is our relationship to ego, right, which is a powerful and important insight, which I, you know, can only applaud, because in both in my own practice and in my work with people, I found that that's consistently true, right, you know, anecdotally, empirically, not from a research basis, which I don't have. And so that when we talk about false self, right, it seems to kind of be excluding something, which simply is, and as you put it, you know, the person at that space in their life is simply doing the best that they can, right, you know, in that false self stage. So why are we actually labeling it false? Is that an accurate reflection of your objection?
Yes, and I'm just looking for a better term. I'm not arguing that there is blindness and delusion and, you know, all kinds of contortions and stuff that happens. But I just find it not compassionate enough to use the word false.
Right. Well, number one, you know, I think it'll be wonderful for you to express that in the book, because it's a really important perspective that needs to be expressed, because there is too much ego bashing and ego killing. Having said that, just, you know, without getting stuck on this in our dialogue, but just to at least offer a different perspective and to try and explain why, you know, I and Ken and others actually, Winnicott, actually have some preference for this term. Right, and that's as follows. When we talk in the world of the non-dual, you know, the ultimate non-dual, the non-dual that incorporates all the levels of consciousness, that incorporates duality, right, then at that level, we actually feel that there is a need, right, to create, right, hierarchies, right, that actually the possibilities of making judgment are actually necessary, and the possibilities of valuation, discernment, and distinction are necessary, right? And that actually in, you know, the human emergence, right, there are preferred, right, and less preferred. There actually are preferences, if you will, right? We prefer someone, right, in their authentic self, which is profoundly compassionate and ethical. And indeed, your reason, paradoxically, for not liking false self is because you're looking for a more compassionate term, right? I think that was your word. So actually, right, the compassionate self, right, the self that is most authentic, most aligned with its, you know, ultimately realized nature, right, is actually preferred, and that when we begin in levels of consciousness, right, to refuse to acknowledge hierarchies, right, it's not clear to me that that's actually a non-dual perspective from it that's transpersonal, but actually there's something pre-personal about that there's actually some level one, level three, you know, perhaps confusion, right, or a pre-trans fallacy taking place. So when we're talking about false self, we're not talking about it from a pre-perspective. We're not talking about it without the realization that it has a place, but we're actually just kind of driving a stake in the ground, if you will. Sorry for that masculine term. Or we're, you know, I just realized how masculine that term was, right? we're actually pointing out that actually there are hierarchies. And hierarchies don't disappear from a non-dual perspective, right? They exist, you know, in their non-dual matrix. So without getting stuck in this, that would be, I think, our response to the usage of the term false self, you know, which is a great conversation.
So then I can certainly agree with that, and I certainly would advocate also for making distinctions, because that's the very thing that, at least in the work I'm doing, is the chief distinguisher among different levels is how many distinctions can you make and of what.
Exactly right.
And certainly hierarchical, that some things indeed work better and are more effective and efficient than others, more flexible, more compassionate. All of that is true. I just find the term static. Maybe that's one other simple way of saying it, rather than dynamic, which would be more just more to my liking. But let's just leave that aside.
I live with
it the way it's being used, and I just always hope that people who are not already capable of making those distinctions from a later perspective are then not tempted to in some ways find themselves as false, and instead of focusing on the growth potential and what's good about themselves, sort of getting stuck on that false, thinking they're false in some ways, or struggling with the idea what would it mean to be authentic if you're at the conventional level. So I guess I'm standing up a bit for those who cannot look at it from the later perspectives.
From the non-dual
or the big mind, or you know, whichever word we want to use.
Fantastic. No, that's fantastic. I just want to, just as we close this conversation, I just want to just point out to everyone that Suzanne just added a subtle dimension to her objection, which I want to just receive, because I completely agree with it, and I think it needs to be said, right? You know, what Suzanne just added, and I'm sorry for talking about you in the third person in this moment, but what Suzanne just added was what I would call an aesthetic concern, using the word aesthetic like Kant uses it, you know, in your distinction between a dynamic and a static term, right? And I think that that's a really, really important thing to talk to, right? That is to say, whenever we use language, we're limited, right? And a word like false, right, has, as Suzanne says, a kind of static quality that almost grates on us, right? You know, in other words, Suzanne's objection, as she's pointing it out to, which I'm actually, you know, endorsing and subscribing to, right, is, as we've now clarified it, I think we've actually clarified this far beyond our email exchange, it's not a conceptual objection per se, because conceptually, actually, Suzanne, Ken, and I all agree about the need for discernment and you know, in these hierarchies, and indeed Suzanne's entire system, right, points towards, right, these levels of discernment and distinction, right, and additional perspectives as demarcating higher or deeper levels of consciousness. But what Suzanne's talking about is, again, what we might call, I'd like to call it now, an aesthetic, right, issue, a subtle aesthetic issue, which is that the term false by itself, right, is static, and if we could actually identify that place in a more dynamic way, it might allow for growth in a deeper way. So that's a good end bracket to this, you know, note on false self on that particular level. So now let's move into the essence of our conversation. I thought that was really a really helpful clarification. Right, let's move into the essence of our conversation and begin to look at unique self, you know, within levels of consciousness, particularly within Suzanne's system. And I'm just going to say a minute about Suzanne's system and then, you know, begin looking at, and the way we're going to do the dialogue that we is simply to look at, you know, just as a kind of, you know, loose framework, look at where, Suzanne, you begin intuitively, naturally, you know, and as a function of general speech to use the term uniqueness. Right, then we'll just actually follow through your article. I'll actually read you different passages from different levels, and we can actually look at that, which will give us a really nice frame. But before we do that, for all of you who are unfamiliar with ego development theory, which Suzanne has developed, which emerges in part out of Jane Loveridge's work, and then Suzanne has added, you know, and erected whole new edifices, not in the sense of edifice complex, but wonderful edifices, right, to this particular levels of consciousness story, this particular, as you term it, Suzanne, in your article, this is one story of human development we can tell. Right? This describes what Suzanne calls a psychological system. Right? It has three interrelated components in describing the emergence of levels of consciousness. Right? It has what we might call the operative component, which looks at what adults see as the purpose of life, what needs they act upon, and what ends they're moving towards. That's one. Two is it has the the effective, so we'll talk about the effective, the second is the affective component, affective with an A, which deals with emotions and the experiences of being in the world, right? And three, there's a cognitive component, which addresses the question of how a person thinks about him or herself in the world, okay? And these three, which we might, you know, which Suzanne labels doing, being, and thinking, right? Right, that each stage of consciousness that Suzanne is describing emerges from an interaction, or as she terms it, a synthesis, right, between doing, being, and thinking, right? So even though we're using the term, you know, psychological, we're not talking about logic and its limited, you know, mind sense and emphasis on cognition, but about this you know, organic synthesis between doing, being, and thinking, and those are the basic three levels that are described in those ascending stages of consciousness. So, Suzanne, that's a fair description?
Yes, lovely. Always nice to hear it through the eyes and heart of somebody else.
Fantastic. And I had to make up for my sin last time and made sure that I was better studied. So that's excellent. That's excellent. So I actually, everyone on this call, whenever you're talking about someone else's theory, you need a gold star from the teacher. So my major goal today was to get a gold star from the teacher. So now we begin to look at, you know, with delight, you know, how unique self, right, plays here. And just to mention, if you take a look at Suzanne's article, you'll actually see that these levels of consciousness, right, appear, you know, differently in different groups of people, obviously, right? And if you actually look, you'll see that there's, you know, a very, very, very small group of people at the highest levels of consciousness, which Suzanne describes as unitive. I think in one survey there was 0.9, right, in the Great Britain, and 0.5 in the United States. And at, you know, other levels that we're going to talk about, there's much greater groups of people, you know, much larger groups of people. So the first group that we're going to talk about, that I'm going to talk about, is the beginning of Suzanne's post-conventional stages. It's called the post-conventional stages. Suzanne calls it the individualist. And in Great Britain, in her survey, you had about 23.4% of people who appeared at this level. And in the United States, about 11.3%, right, in two particular empirical studies. And in this individualist stage, right, well, perhaps, Suzanne, perhaps we begin by you describing the individualist stage. I'll just point out, I'm just going to read one sentence from Suzanne. This is the beginning of the use of the term uniqueness in Suzanne's article, and as we'll see, it appears variously and shifts. But in this particular place, right, it appears where Suzanne writes that individualists distrust conventional wisdom and the hyper-rational tenets of the conscientious stage, which is part of the conventional stage, an earlier level of consciousness, right? They need to distance themselves from all that went before them. In this case, one must reevaluate the self-adopted yet sanctioned role identities of society and redefine oneself uniquely and independently of them based on one's own experience and conclusions. So maybe tell us a little bit about the individualist stage, and we'll see, right, is this a place where the unique self begins to come online, although clearly not fully?
To me here, the biggest new thing from before is this turning inward and this reliance on one's experience as sort of the guiding framing of who am I, is simply What can I sense? What do I experience, regardless of what I was taught before that I need to be, which is this really major shift in cognition, also from being unconscious of one's own social and cultural programming to becoming more and more conscious of that, and how much is actually not self-generated, but just imbibed by living, you know, like a fish in water, in our environments and in our cultural context. We can't help it to get ideas of who one should be and what it is means to be an adult and all of that. So the uniqueness here is to the discovery of who am I independently of all of what I've learned. Just who, and the big question at that level is, who am I? And the big confusion as well, because people really at that level often are deeply, deeply confused. And because they are already fairly mature, they can handle that confusion. They can actually live in it and just sort of explore it and even delight in it. So I'm this person when I'm talking to Mark Gaffney. I'm this person talking about myself when I'm with my daughter or when I'm teaching. It's a sense of having multiple ways of being. And at this level, they don't necessarily, I may not necessarily know of a central, unique self. Just all these different ways I can be. Is fascinating to me.
No, I think that distinction is very important. In other words, at this level, there's not yet what we might call the full emergence of unique self, what you just termed intuitively as central unique self, right? It's not that we're at that level of kind of you're acting spontaneously, naturally from your unique self, right? But you're actually, it's actually a search place. Actually, the way that you say it is, right, in this level, you again use the term uniqueness. It's the second time in this article that the term uniqueness appears. Right, and by the way, since I didn't have this in a search program, I actually had to read the article carefully, Eddie. I couldn't search the term uniqueness, right? So instead, they turn inward in search of their unique gifts, right, which is, of course, a major term in unique self-thinking. They turn inward in search of their unique gift or pursuing their own burning questions. So I think that sentence is important because it actually frames how you're using uniqueness, right? The two descriptions of the sentence are unique gifts and burning questions, that there's a search for, you know, moving beyond the grid, you know, or to borrow our friend Larry Wachowski's term, you know, the matrix. You know, I want to step out of the matrix, and there's a kind of realization that I'm actually in the matrix, right? That realization comes online, and I want to begin to actually live independently. The way we would describe this level in Kabbalah, in Kabbalistic consciousness, would be through a particular koan, which says anyone who says something in the name of the person who said it brings redemption to the world. It's an old 4th century Aramaic Hebrew statement. And the way you kind of feel into the koan is if you can say something in the name of the person who said it, that is, you have enough distance to realize what actually is emerging from you and what are you actually repeating, right? Repeating, you're aware that you're saying something in the name of the person that said it. Instead of it being an automatic repetition, instead of you being lost in the matrix, then you're beginning to move towards your own redemption, which would be kind of a Hebraic term for enlightenment. So this is not full unique self, but it's the beginning. Uniqueness comes online here, or an awareness of uniqueness comes online. Uniqueness is actually always already present, yet at all the levels of consciousness, but a kind of an awareness or a desire for uniqueness, you know, a move towards, you know, to quote you, the search for the unique gift, right? The desire to actually find and quote, you know, quoting you again, redefine oneself uniquely. So there's an active move towards uniqueness, which kind of demarcates, right, this particular level of consciousness, even if it's not, you know, it's not fully, you know, embodied. You know, there's the beginning of a move towards embodied awareness, right? There's more of a now orientation, you know. You know, and that's and this is somewhat similar. This is somewhat similar to, you know, the emergence of levels of consciousness. I don't want to label it with a particular color in the spiral dynamic scheme, but you know, particular levels that appear there. Obviously, you know, they have different ways of telling the story, right? But uniqueness really comes on board here, and you actually use it a third time, right, in describing this level, where you describe, right, the desire of a person and their ability to live life according to their own unique style, their own unique style, right? So here, for the first time, three times, uniqueness comes on board here, right? And again, I'm fully aware that you're not using it, the term formally. We haven't had a unique self conversation, but I think it's fascinating to follow the language, and as we'll see, your use of the word uniqueness is going to change, right, as you go up levels of consciousness. So I think here, unique style is just a nice way of saying it. You know, you begin to become free from what you call restrictive conventions. So I think we have the beginning of uniqueness coming on board here. So now the next stage, Suzanne, The next stage, Suzanne, would be the autonomous stage,
mm-hmm.
right? Stage five, the strategist. So can you tell us a little bit about that stage?
In some ways, it is a solution to the previous sort of searching. It's finding a place within oneself, which I call a core self, or something that's fundamentally now recognized as being there and functioning to hold everything together in spite of all the new capacities to question and to be open and to not fix things and not need, you know, a defined role or a defined self, a sense of permanence that comes beyond that search. This is me. This is really what I think I am. With all the warts and all the, what's it called in English, the warts and all, I guess.
No, warts and all is good.
a much deeper sense of who I am that actually therefore also can now make decisions again, whereas before that was sort of almost impossible and something that Spiral Dynamics, certainly in their version of green, always mentions, not wanting to commit to anything particular, an inability to actually make choices and look at things in a hierarchical way. Here that is possible again because of that sense of, core self is the best word I can find. And far less confusion than before.
Far less confusion than before. Right, a sense of core self that comes on board, right, and together with that, you know, in the autonomous self, just to kind of reflect back, Suzanne, you know, and again, this is as a integral philosopher, and you know, my role, you know, we talk about sub identities, you know, in the autonomous stage, and how we're able to, you know, integrate previously compartmentalized sub identities. So I was just thinking about, you know, our different roles. You know, sometimes we appear in the role of, you know, a husband or a father or a partner. I'm now appearing in the role of, you know, the partner to my partner, Mariana Kaplan, and who's now, by the way, was now almost 5 months expecting.
Oh,
so I'm in that. Yeah. So it's a particular role. And then, you know, I just came back from JFK. You know, where I did the keynote on unique self, that was the role of an integral philosopher. And then later in the day, Diane and I are giving a course. That's the role of a spiritual teacher. We have different roles, right, different sub-identities, if you will, different voices, and we begin in the autonomous stage, you point out, to integrate them. They begin to become integrated, you know, and you begin to use the term self-actualization here,
mm-hmm.
right? There's kind of self-determination, self-actualization. But most importantly, right, you point out that, you know, we're moving past the confusion, and where truth can be approximated, right? You know, more complex arguments carry more weight than feeble ones. There's an ability to actually make discernment. You know, higher is more adequate for functioning. You know, in an ever more complex global theater, qualitative differences actually come back online post this place that Spiral Dynamics describes as green, right? Shadow is acknowledged. A greater, you know, degree of wholeness is possible. And what that all creates in terms of unique self is, and again, I want to stay very close to your writing here. Is although you don't use the word uniqueness again, comes back online here with you in this level of consciousness, but you use it differently than at the independent stage. And so I want to read it to you, right? You point out that depression is often based on loss of courage, loss of self-agency, and guilt for not having fulfilled one's unique human promise, right, which is the promise to become the most one can be, right? And there's a responsibility, and you actually underline the word responsible. It wasn't a casual word. It's the only word underlined, actually, in this entire section, right? Responsible, person becomes responsible for fulfilling their unique human promise, and that would be the place where unique self-consciousness begins to emerge more sharply in what we call in unique self terms. You begin to feel your unique obligation, right? That the actual notion of obligation comes back on board, not in a mythic sense, right? You know, not in the conformist or even the conscientious stages, right, of the conventional, but here in this post-conventional place, there's a kind of reclaiming of a sense of obligation. So here, when you talk about uniqueness, it's not just uniqueness, right, that you're kind of searching for your uniqueness as your burning question to find your unique gift, but you actually intuitively up-level it. There's actually an obligation here, right, to fulfill your unique human promise. You're responsible, underlined, to become the most that one can be. So which is an emergence of unique self, which I think is precisely reflects how we understand the unique self. So I thought that was fantastic.
And listening to it, you know, through you, I hear that, and I also hear that this another aspect of this new stage is, of course, it's full acceptance and acknowledgement of interdependence, which is really the first time when that comes up on board, whereas the previous stage, there is this independence is still there. I'm creating all of these things. I'm trying to figure it out. Here we have cognitively the capacity to see oneself as part of larger systems, and therefore the notion of obligation, there is a relationship between me and others that wasn't as conscious as it is now, and therefore I think the response ability and the obligation comes back on board and becomes powerful.
Responsibility and obligation, yes, becomes back on board and powerful, right? And again, you know, I'm you know, citing Suzanne Cook-Reuter to Suzanne Cook-Reuter, right, which is a unique methodology in conducting a dialogic process, which is that when you talk about responsibility here, right, you talk both about responsibility in the interdependent sense, which is what you're emphasizing now, but in the article, you actually emphasize responsibility to fulfill your own unique promise, your own, quote, unique human promise, right, to become the most that one can be. So the emphasis in the article, right, is not only on interdependence, which also has a place there, but there's a strong emphasis on your obligation actually to become the unique you that you are.
Yes, you're right. It's fascinating method to feedback things one has written to the person who's written.
It's delightful.
Hear it differently, perhaps. Yeah. And that is what we in the ISC certainly looked at as the unique self. What is it about each person that they that only they can bring to life and nobody else?
Right.
The self-actualization, to use that word, the way Maslow also used it, is indeed at this level. So what is it that I have to, first I have to find it, and then how do I actually express it so that it can fully blossom and do its most good in the world?
Yeah, you know, that's fantastic. And of course, the interdependent context, you know, that you point out, right, it is critical because, as you say, you know, one needs the caring presence of others to become the most one can be, right? So when there's a need, right, that's a direct quote, one needs the caring presence of others to become the most one can be. So others are vital to one's well-being because only through a dynamic and intimate exchange with them can one gain deeper self-knowledge and wisdom, right? So paradoxically, in your framing here again, you know, the framing really, really supports the notion of your obligation to, you're no longer just searching for your gift in terms of self-identity, as you were in the previous stage, but you're actually feeling the obligation. You're feeling the obligation, and that is precisely, in the way I've understood unique self, precisely what happens, right, as unique self clarifies, right, the actual, you know, the obligation comes back on board at second tier, right, in a way that's very, very different than the conformist or the conscientious level. Okay. So now let's up level. Let's up level here. So now we're going to go to, right, the unitive stages, right, and then we're going to look particularly at let's look precisely at the construct aware stage, and kind of see, and maybe you could just describe for us what happens here. What is this unit of stage as we're up leveling here? This construct aware stage, and then afterwards, right, the stage six, which is the ironist stage.
What to me is the qualitatively new thing here that wasn't present before is a capacity to differentiate and question even more deeply than at the individualist level just how we make sense of things, and to become even more deeply aware that one is not just culturally and socially programmed, but fundamentally programmed as long and as deeply as one is embedded in any kind of language, because language itself creates a structure that parses reality in such a way that we don't even know that it does that. We just assume that is how the world is because our languages and our metaphors almost force us into seeing the world that way. And to become aware of that is a much deeper disillusionment, if you will, than even the first level disillusionment at the individualist level.
And
it takes great strength to actually be sitting with this and to find ways to accept that and find the obligation and even rethink that obligation, because it can be quite disheartening and, again, in some ways confusing, thinking, well, I thought I knew what I was about. I thought I found a deep human way of being in the world, doing the best I can do, self-actualize, and by my own self-actualization also model and help others self-actualize. Now you're suddenly not so sure that this is all not just another, you know, self-delusion, another
right.
way of aggrandizing and feeling powerful and strong. And so for some people, this level is very, very painful.
And at this level, you know, and we're describing now, you know, the beginning of the unit of stages for all of you beautiful listeners, right? And we're talking particularly about, you know, the construct aware stage, which is kind of 5-6, the construct aware stage. And here, part of what happens is, in Suzanne's description is, and again, I'm going to quote her directly, right? Again, the third person, right? There's moments in which the personal self disappears, right? You know, the regular practice of turning inward and observing one's own mental processes also often leads to the spontaneous experience, right, Suzanne writes, of a direct mode of being in which knower and known momentarily merge and the personal self disappears, right? And these states, which, you know, what these are is, you know, in my terms, I would say these are glimmers of true self, right? They're glimmers of true self. They've been called peak moments, P-E-A-K. You know, I might call them glimmers, that is peak moments, P-E-E-K, right? They're peaks, right? They're peaks of true self where there's a kind of bliss experience, there's a flow state. You know, they've been described variously by the researchers in the field. And, of course, we know them as states of consciousness, whether you're accessing a state of true self where the personal self, you know, has disappeared, and that in these flow states, right, there's a process of, you know, quoting Suzanne again, dismantling the vestiges of the conditional self, right? And so that, you know, other states of consciousness, you know, higher, deeper states, you're accessing these places of true self can be accomplished, right? And although there's glimmers of this through drugs, we're not recommending that on this phone call. We would prefer recommending to you devoted meditation practices. But again, it's very, very important stage, and this is part of what is necessary in actually cutting through, you know, the earlier stages, the kind of aggrandizement that can occur in the earlier stages. And there's a need to kind of disillusion again, to cut through, barring Trungpa's term, you know, spiritual materialism, right, and to kind of really, really, you know, you know, let the personal self disappear here in some sense. So that's a whole new stage. Now here's the fascinating thing, that when we up level one more time, okay, when we up level to level six, so at this level, Suzanne, you don't describe uniqueness at all. The term uniqueness doesn't appear, right? Because, which of course makes sense, because, you know, although uniqueness is still present, right? But this is really about getting beyond what we might call the vestiges of self-aggrandizement that happen whenever we're engaged in uniqueness, right? And there's a kind of dissolution, there's a kind of contact with the purity of the transcendent, with these moments of true self, of bliss, of flow, right? But then, and here's what's great, when you return, right, to the higher unit of stage of consciousness, right, the ironist stage, all of a sudden in your writing, uniqueness comes back online dramatically, and, ready for this, Suzanne, you actually use the term unique self. Right? For the first time, right? And again, you know, since there's no accents in language, you know, from my mystical perspective at this moment, from my, as a linguistic mystic at this very moment, take on that sub-identity is delightful and not surprising. So let me, if I can, read Suzanne to Suzanne, right? So in describing the stage, the second unit of stage, the ironist stage, right, post the construct-aware stage, so Suzanne writes as follows, which is a precise description, really a much more precise description of unique self in the way it's more ultimate post-enlightenment sense that we were using it at the conference. And let me actually correct, not post-enlightenment, but also post-enlightening. We should never make enlightenment a kind of static place. Mariana, my partner, has written very beautifully in a book called Halfway Up the Mountain about premature claims to enlightenment and about how we kind of need to use the word enlightenment as a verb. So Suzanne writes, the new paradigm has the universal or cosmic perspective. So here there's a shift of perspective of, again, to a kind of cosmocentric perspective. And here's the key sentences. Unitive individuals experience themselves and others as part of ongoing humanity, embedded in the creative ground, fulfilling the destiny of evolution. So here, again, there's an evolutionary context, which is essential to this highest level of unique self. And the two sides of the Pascalian paradox are integrated. On the one hand, feelings of belongingness, right? On the other hand, right, feelings of separateness and uniqueness, right, actually demarcate this stage, and uniqueness, right, and belongingness are experienced without undue tension, right, as changing perceptions of many possibilities of being. And I would just add that actually at the stage of unique self, uniqueness and belongingness actually merge as one, right, that actually it's through your uniqueness that you actually merge. Right? That's what uniqueness actually adds here, right? Unique self-thinking adds that it's paradoxically through your unique self, your puzzle piece nature, that you actually experience, right, your unitive manifestation. Not only is there no tension, but uniqueness becomes, right, the very way that you merge, right? And there's, you know, and this kind of person is, you were struck by the humility and grace, right, of this dimension of ourselves or such people. And finally, right, let me just finish with Suzanne and then turn it over to you, right? You kind of go into a kind of almost a song of uniqueness in the way you use it. You use it time and again. You talk about the person at the unitive stage becoming aware of themselves as separate and unique embodiments, right, that also identify with all other living beings. So, of course, this isn't separate at the level of separate self. This isn't separate at the level of conformist or conscientious. This is classical unique self-separateness. Meaning, it's not really, I would actually remove the word separate. It's your unique embodiment, as you say, which is at the same time identified. And then a couple of sentences later, again, you talk about this unit of adult having an integrated sense of unique identity, right? You have a unique identity as a participant in the evolutionary process. The person's completely lined up with your unique life's work, which is a simultaneous expression of their unique self, right, as part of their shared humanity. So actually, wonderfully, at this last stage that you describe, you use uniqueness more than any other stage, and you use it more poetically than any other stage because you're kind of sensing its poetic emergence. And most importantly, right, you point out that at this stage, uniqueness, right, and being one with, belonging, being identified with all living beings are actually the same, that the tension between them disappears and they merge, right, and express as one, which is precisely, I mean, gorgeously, precisely, that is what happens at unique self. That is, this is now, right, the level, the expression of unique self that we were pointing towards at Integral Spiritual Experience. That, I thought that was quite wonderful. I was utterly delighted.
And I'm surprised and delighted as well. Sometimes one intuits things that, because this is the time and what I had been reading, this was not yet expressed anywhere. I had to kind of struggle and try and give words to it, and it does resonate with what we have been talking ever since that term came up.
Yeah, you know, I this is just a fascinating thing. I first coined the term unique self in a book, Soul Prince, published in, about 10 years ago. You know, about 10 years ago, somewhere in kind of 99, something like that. And it's just wonderful. When you and I first did our dialogue, you know, we were kind of grasping, you know, we were looking for the place. And I kind of had this intuition last night, I need to go back and reread. So I went back and reread, and I literally, the first time I read the article, I didn't notice it. And I read it quickly the first time, you know, too quickly. And then as I noticed, the first time I noticed unique, I said, oh, that's interesting. Interesting how she uses that there. That was at the individualist stage. And I said, well, why don't I watch for that? So I went back and reread and kind of circled all the times that you used uniqueness and actually realized that from the individualist to the unitive stage, you actually described intuitively, right, the actual emergence of the clarification, you know, what we call in Luria's Kabbalah, Berur, B-E-R-U-R, which literally means the clarification of uniqueness. So your article really is an actual process of Berur, really the clarification of uniqueness and what it might mean, and each time you use it, right, it shifts and gets and becomes a higher and higher expression. So I just think it's just an utterly, utterly delightful, and unexpected surprise for me as well. Right, in this dialogue is to really see how intuitively and precisely you actually traced, you know, by unpacking these terms, right, that unfolding of unique self from its initial emergences, right, or its initial coming into consciousness to its more full and beautiful expression. Wow.
That's about, I'm sort of sitting here with my mouth a bit open. Wow, it's a translation and the bodily expression. Yes, that is amazing to me as well. And, of course, now I'm asking myself, why did I have such a struggle with this term?
The term that you used.
Well, isn't that fascinating how you can get hung up, if you will, or experience resistance to something that when you it's just funny, it's just so human nature to,
it's hilarious, right? I mean, this is it's hilarious
and resist something just because you don't even remember you thought about it yourself.
It's hilarious. I think this is just—it's hilarious in the best sense of the term, in the high divine laughter.
Yes, and beautiful in the sense as well, because
utterly beautiful. Yeah, really utterly. Yeah, no.
Confirms in some ways to me, coming from a sort of non-enlightened place, to come up with similar kinds of ideas and feelings and sentiments about what it means to be a human being and what it can mean, alongside with those who have all the information and training and access to these later states that I may not have. To me, it's just a fascinating confirmation that we're onto something real.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think we really are onto something real. And, you know, I want to just, you know, end with just thanking you for doing these two dialogues and, you know, the first one and the second one. And, you know, together they really are going to be for a lot of people, you know, an important conversation that people will refer to back, you know, back and back again as we unfold unique self within the community. And the clarity of your writing on the stages of consciousness has really informed, you know, so many of us, you know, and that's obviously an expression of your unique self, you know, the ability to actually trace and unfold these levels, or at least one particular dimension of it, and just to look forward to future conversations and, you know, in our community, in which hopefully we really engage in what we call in Aramaic chavruta. And chavruta is the kind of egoless discussion as we search together for truth, and there's a kind of delight to that conversation, and it's that's the energy of delight I felt in this conversation, and I want to bow and thank you for it.
Likewise here, and I'm keeping that Lake Mackenzie on that isle in mind, the clarity and the light sparkling on it, and the purity of it, even the taste of the water.
Mm-hmm.
I wish to leave with all of you.
Thank you very much, Suzanne. A beautiful day to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.